Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
I'm schwitzing, Jeff, but hi.
On today's show, we talk about 16 and 18. But first, there are some good things happening with the current Mets. The situation is not great overall, but there are some good signs. We'll start with DJ Stewart, Ronnie Mauricio, and Mark Vientos. DJ Stewart, as I mentioned last week, is making a statement that he should be on the 2024 Mets. He may have figured it out at the right time. As Joel Sherman wrote, the Mets have to figure out if this is a new DJ Stewart or it's an aberration, but it's certainly positive. Ronnie Mauricio had a great weekend, and the Mets did too, taking two of three from Seattle. But we finally got to see Ronnie Mauricio, and he hit the ball hard, he stole bases, and was a positive force for the Mets. And Mark Vientos, finally getting playing time, hit two home runs. So, Greg, three positives right there.
I hope DJ Stewart is not an aberration, not an apparition, that he is for real, even if he's not. He's having the time of his life. He got together with Bill Medley and Jennifer Warnes, and nobody puts DJ Stewart in a corner. Listen, you want to call him a journeyman? Fine. His journey has led here. It has led to a hell of a few weeks and some great adventures in right field that always seem to wind up with the ball in his glove and just a generally great attitude toward getting the chance he got finally, making the most of it. Being a centerpiece of the lineup in a way I had given up on in terms of looking at the lineup past maybe the first four spots for the rest of the year. Now between Stewart as something of the glue in the middle of the lineup and some of these young guys getting that chance as well. It's actually something you look forward to seeing 1 through 9 mostly. And if you can't have 1 through 9 all together, that's not a bad place to be. Very delighted to see what Ronnie Mauricio has been up to. He seemed like an apparition. He seemed like a longstanding urban myth. I don't know how many years. He can't be that many because he's not very old. But it felt like he was the number one prospect ages ago. And then he sort of was surpassed in the popular imagination by others who raced to make it to the big leagues before he did. And we certainly spent a great deal of this season looking at highlights and looking at statistics and wondering what's he got to do to get up here and being told, well, he has to learn this, that, and the other thing about the game, which is all reasonable, but it was like, yeah, you know what? We're not going anywhere. How about some Ronnie Mauricio for his troubles? And he came up and he looks like a keeper, as they say. You know, I don't know what that really means. But for a few days in September, at least, he looks like he belongs. Looks like he knows what he's doing offensively and defensively, playing second base, not his natural position. We know he's going to have to carve out position space where he can because shortstop is taken for the foreseeable future. So it's delightful to watch a kid come up and live up to the hype. And Vientos, it's nice to see him finally settling in a little bit, maybe a little less nervous than he's been in his other cameos. We hope his foot is okay. We hope that there is ample opportunity in September, assuming his foot is okay, for young Mr. Vientos, young Mr. Beatty to get back on track, the continuation of young Mr. Mauricio, and hey, I think I've seen a couple of base hits recently from young Mr. Alvarez, who was the apple of our eye not that long ago when he was making the apple in center field rise. Long slump, which I think may just be a matter of first full year getting the hang of things. Go back, as I know you like to do, Jeff, and everybody else, go back and look at the game logs for Juan Swoboda in 1965. Ron Swoboda had a very similar season to what Francisco Alvarez has been going through. Just the answer to Mets fans' prayers in year four of the Mets' existence, a homegrown bopper. And he didn't necessarily have a position the way Alvarez does, but I think he had 15 home runs by the All-Star break, which was an incredible thing. And he had 4 after the All-Star break. And he went on to be Ron Swoboda, which was not a bad thing overall. Francisco Alvarez was up to, what, 21 home runs the night after the trade deadline. Hit a dramatic home run in Kansas City, doing what he does. He was four home runs, I think, behind Johnny Bench for the rookie catcher home run record, which was going to fall any week now. He's still a 21. But let's remember also that Francisco Alvarez is he still a 21 himself, maybe? 21, 22, it doesn't matter. None of it really matters if it doesn't work out in the short term, and we will take from it everything that does work out and imbue it with significance. So it's great to see everybody getting a shot. It's great to see not only Alvarez, by the way, but the guy we got in the offseason, Omar Narvaez, who seemed to be lost at sea much of the year. I'm not claiming he's been tearing up the pea patch, but he's actually been pretty, seems like a pretty good major league player and a good alternate. I won't say backup to Alvarez. So you see people kind of settling in a little bit. We've seen, you know, again, a guy I don't think either of us was familiar with. I certainly wasn't. Jonathan Arayuz playing great defense at third base. I don't know how many more reps he's going to get because we've got a lot of third basemen suddenly. But it's not nice to see these guys. Ortega had some really good games. You know, it is our impulse as fans to look at guys we haven't heard of or guys we're vaguely aware of, that borderline major league, high minor league player that, you know, we snort at, quite frankly, when they're here, especially for a team that wasn't doing that great, and they all get a shot. And eventually they come through a little bit. Again, if they come through a lot, if everybody was coming through a lot, we'd be going crazy. But it's all right. This is the season we have. This is the business we've chosen or have had chosen for us by the standings. This is a nice bunch of players to spend time with for a few weeks.
Where is the pea patch exactly?
The pea patch is somewhere on the other side of the old ball yard.
You mentioned Mauricio's been around a while. I think it was 2019. I drove an hour to Hagerstown, Maryland, a town which no longer has a major league, minor league, a major league affiliate because of the Manfred contraction of the minor leagues. But I wanted to see Mauricio play. I think it was for the Columbia Mets, and it was an 11 a.m. camp game, and he did not start. But he has been in our conscious for a while. But let me ask you this. Mauricio, and I've talked about this on the show before, is currently without a position. He's at second base. Doesn't mean he's going to be at second base next year. They could say in the winter they want to make him the left fielder or the third baseman. I'm concerned that the Mets are doing this again with Luis Angel Acuña. He's a shortstop, just like Lindor. He's a center fielder, just like Nimmo, just like Drew Gilbert, who they acquired in the Verlander trade. And Acuña, his bat may be ready next year. And Billy has said that he doesn't want to introduce additional elements to confuse the player and make it harder. But at some point, the player's bat's going to be ready, and you can use his lack of a position as an excuse not to call him up. Why not move them around sooner than later?
Well, Billy Epler has explained the rationale behind that, I suppose. I mean, I never really thought of it in that way until he gave that explanation, because I know that in the minor leagues, you generally see more positions than one, unless you know a guy is going to be your first baseman next year and for the next X number of years, hopefully. That's how you wind up with somebody like Jeff McNeil, who they can feel confident sticking in left field, because now Mauricio is playing second base and they have felt confident sticking McNeil in right field and at third base at various times, and has taken very brief moments at first base and shortstop and center field. You know what? I figure it all comes in time. If I have to wait till July to see Acuña as opposed to seeing him in May, if it's a matter of molding him as much as they can to do as much as he can, I'm not going to second guess that. I mean, it did feel like Mauricio should have been on another position soon after they got Lindor, because you knew that Lindor is your shortstop for the next 10 years, at least on paper. But I could see where you don't want to blow a kid's mind and say, while you're learning to hit the breaking ball, go out and become a third baseman when you weren't one before, or whatever the position would be. Again, I'm sure it's crossed their minds. I mean, I have no idea what the timetable is for Acuna. Like I said in a recent show, kind of backed off these guys until they're close. So I will take their word for it. If indeed Billy Epler's word is what we should be taking vis-a-vis whoever else might be making decisions come the offseason. No need to rush anybody before they're feeling good about what that player can do at a foundational level, at a fundamental level, at an elemental level, building up his confidence. If that's the judgment, I can live with it. They're not asking me anyway.
This concerns me more than it does you. I think Acuna could be ready as early as next spring, but let's hope that the Mets management has their finger on this and will not do the same thing with Acuna or even Gilbert as they have done with Mauricio and keep him without a position. We have Quintana and Senga also pitching well. That's only two-fifths of a rotation, but it makes you wonder if Quintana was healthy all of this season, we would have had less Peterson, less McGill. The season might have gone better. Quintana and Senga give us two-fifths of a rotation for next year. And I think that's at least two-fifths makes us happy.
I know a reliever who, if we'd had him this year, we might have been better off too. You can't worry about it. Quintana was hurt. He had to recover. Quintana has had, I think, one subpar start since he came back, has done some just professional pitching. It's what you love to see. I got really excited the night he got his first win because it came in tandem with the first Met save for Trevor Gott and the first Met home run by Tim LeCastro. Quintana had pitched so well and was not rewarded until he got his first Met win. This was all in the same game. And if you wonder where I'm going to 1967 because that's the last time it happened. A first win, first save, and first home run for the Mets in the same game by three different players. And that night, it was Tom Seaver getting, or actually it was a day, getting his first win in the major leagues. I believe it was Tommy Davis with the home run and I think Ron Taylor with the save. I should probably know that because I wrote a whole thing about it recently. But regardless, Quintana has, if not been a revelation, he has lived up to what they got him to be. That's upper half of the rotation starters, certainly upper half of this rotation. And what can you say about Senga? Senga has just continued to do it like he's been doing it for months. Again, I can't remember the last truly bad start he had. I mean, he may have been shaky in Kansas City, but other than that, has just been the guy I think contenders don't want to face. And as far as McGill and Peterson, you know, they've, I'd say, made incremental progress. They're a little better now than they were, which isn't saying a lot. You know, they had very good starts here and there early in the season. They didn't have enough of them to maintain spots in the rotation when there were other options, which there are not now. We're in a spot really where we have a four-man starting rotation, which we've been able to get away with because of off days and such. And, you know, the demise of Carlos Carrasco as a dependable starting pitcher speaks volumes, unfortunately. And we'll see how they fill things out. Want to give a tip of the cap to Denji Reyes, who I had nothing good to say about going into his most recent start. But he held the fort for more than five innings when this was a guy who went like one and a third against the Braves. And I think that was the 21-3 game. So the rest of the schedule does not have as many off days. And it will be interesting to see. We can say interesting because since there are really no stakes here for the Mets, it will be interesting to see how they go about filling five spots every 5 days or 6 days. I know they like to give Senga the extra rest. You'd love it if Senga could pitch every 5 days, but why push him if this is what you know you're dealing with? You're dealing with a pitcher who never did that before, who's only got X number of starts left, whose inning count is reaching a career high vis-a-vis where he was in Japan. You're set up 40%, you would think, for next year. Beyond that, that's what the offseason is for. So let young McGill and young Peterson, not as young as they used to be, continue to try to find themselves maybe Carrasco gets out there and digs deep and finds whatever it was that he's been missing. And, you know, maybe a guy like Reyes or somebody else, like Buto, gets a call. Again, we're talking about a few weeks of keeping company with the Mets until they are no longer in our line of sight. So it'll be fun to watch the guys who know what they're doing. Maybe fun to watch guys learn what they're doing and be a little better. And beyond that, there's always the bullpen.
I thought of something that you said when Reyes pitched that great game, because he pitched six innings. He pitched so long that there was no way he was going to stay on the roster after that game. I think they gave him one more day. And I thought of something you said, and I wondered if they had already called an Uber for him or they call it after the game is over.
Fortunately, I think they let him hang around for a couple of days. I want to correct myself. It was Bob Shaw who saved Tom Seaver's first win. I know our listeners were wondering. The funny thing about that first win save home run trifecta, it happened a week before in Seaver's debut. He wasn't the pitcher of record. Chuck Estrada won his first Met game, his only Met game, I believe. Ron Taylor got the save in that one. And Jerry Buchek, sort of the Louis Guillorme of his day, hit his first Met home run. And that didn't happen again for 56 years. So Quintana was in the middle of that, making me very happy. LeCastro, a pinch runner, actually putting the bat to the ball, which was exciting. Makes me think that Vogelbach should be asked to pinch run at least once just to kind of even the karmic scales. And hey, Trevor Gott, he's not hopeless. So there you go.
As long as Vogelbach doesn't try to stretch a single to a double.
No, he's for stretching a double into a single.
A digression here. You mentioned Tom, which is not unusual. Seaver, on Tuesday, there was a brilliant article in The Athletic by Tim Britton on the Tom Seaver Vineyards.
Tim went out to Calistoga to visit Seaver Vineyards, visit with Ann Seaver, Tom's daughter, one of the people who manages the business, did before Tom's passing. And the Seaver Vineyard continues on as a thriving wine maker and marketer and is well regarded in that field. Tim talked to some other people as well about how not only how great the wine is, but how dedicated Tom was and how this place, much like that statue in front of Citi Field, stands as his legacy. It's no surprise to realize that this was something Tom threw himself into, the way he threw himself into becoming the pitcher we all remember and the overwhelming presence we all remember. And, I loved reading that article. I loved thinking of him out there in the fields that he tended. One of the people who runs the place said, I thought of Tom as my best worker because he really took it seriously. And, it wasn't just I'm a celebrity who was interested in wine. Let me put my name on a bottle. This had become his life. And, you wish that everything had gone better and he could have continued to cultivate. But it's great to know the family is still thriving out there and the wine still thriving out there, and they've overcome the wildfires and things like that, which are horrible anywhere. And if you need a motivation to subscribe to The Athletic, look no further if you're a Mets fan than the great job both Tim Britton and Will Salmon have done. Salmon's been on the beat about a year, and Britton back to 2018, just this sort of feature. To parrot so many people who comment on that site. This is why I subscribe to The Athletic. It was a very nice surprise to see that article there Tuesday morning after Labor Day.
And Pete Alonso certainly deserves some discussion. On Sunday, he hit his 40th and 41st home runs. And Greg, you were there. It was Jewish Heritage Day at Citi Field. It would have been a Shanda if the Mets lost. But you were there with friend of the pod, Mark Simon, and you saw Pete make Mets history, and you saw a Mets win.
We were all members of the tribe that day, the tribe of Mesopotamia. Yeah, it was a fun day. The temperature was just rising that day, so it wasn't sweltering, but it was warm. And you get a warm feeling watching Pete Alonso break out of what had been a two-week drought where home runs were concerned. You knew it was coming, becoming the third season in which Pete has hit 40 or more home runs. brought it up to 41 right away. And suddenly we recall that the Met home run record for so many years was 41 in a season. Todd Hundley in 1996, Carlos Beltran 10 years later. It seems so unapproachable. Mike Piazza hit 40 in 2000, and otherwise nobody had really come close. And now, you know, it's a rest stop for Pete Alonso on his way to greater things in a given year. So that was a lot of fun. It was interesting. They said, hey, Pete Alonso's 40th home run on the scoreboard. We all applauded. It. Then he hits his 41st, and Mark and I, who had spent most of the day muddled in all kinds of inane and bizarre Mets trivia, we weren't sure, was that his 100th RBI or not? Because I guess we weren't watching the scoreboard, and they didn't make a big deal out of it, which is kind of absurd, but maybe somebody was just, so full of matzo ball soup or whatever it was they served for Jewish Heritage Day that they were just too full to go on. But yeah, 41 home runs, 100 RBIs with several weeks of the season to go. A rousing Mets win that day. A series taken from the Seattle Mariners squaring the account for early 2022. It all came rushing back to me that we were rolling along, and we would still be rolling along in 2022. But these strangers called the Seattle Mariners came into Citi Field last May and took 2 out of 3 from us. And come to think of it, the game ended, I believe, with Pete Alonso flailing at strike 3. Both Alonso and Marte had absolutely terrible bats with the bases loaded, something like that. Again, it was the tiniest of speed bumps on the Mets' path to a lot of wins that year. Little payback. I didn't know that we had a rivalry with Seattle, but apparently we do. You can create a rivalry, I guess, anytime you want in your head. So I'm glad we... I don't want to screw up the American League playoff chase too much, lest it somehow benefit the Yankees, who are only about 8 games out. Assuming that isn't the case, always nice to make your voice heard.
There has been so much talk about Pete lately, and much of it negatively. Yes, we know that he goes through, as you mentioned, prolonged periods where it doesn't look like he has any idea where the strike zone is or how to make contact. And then he explodes. I hope he stays a Met forever. I love watching him, and there's been some talk about his clubhouse present, which I think is nonsense. Will they trade him? Who knows? I hope that they don't. I hope that we can see Pete remain a Met long enough. His numbers placed alongside 16 and 18.
16, 18, going up in 2024. What a nice surprise to have learned that in the last couple of weeks. It wasn't really on the agenda as far as I know, but hey, I don't make Steve Cohen's agenda. The New York Mets are going to add their, let's see if I've got it right, 8th and 9th number retired, 6th and 7th for players. We know that two numbers have been retired for managers, one of whom played for the Mets. One number has been retired for somebody who played for the Mets kind of briefly, but has an enormous impact on the legacy of National League Baseball in New York. The people I'm talking about, if you're not scoring at home, Casey Stengel and Gil Hodges, huge instrumental figures in Mets baseball's manager, Willie Mays. Who is Willie Mays? That leaves 6 players now who have had their numbers retired by the Mets for what they've done primarily performing on the field. Tom Seaver, number 41. Mike Piazza, number 31. Jerry Kuzman, number 36, Keith Hernandez, number 17, and now Daryl Strawberry, number 18, and Dwight Good, number 16. So that's 6 players out of more than 1,200 being recognized specifically for being the greatest of Mets. And that sounds about right to me. I lived through the 1980s, as you did, as a lot of our listeners did. I lived through the 1980s as a Mets fan who'd been a Mets fan for a long time, entering the 1980s. And if you live through the 1980s as a Mets fan, the only question you would have if you had been transported from the middle of the 80s to, say, next year at Citi Field, once those numbers are hanging, you would ask, how do they keep those numbers so spotless and clean, considering they must have been hanging up there for so many years? Because Doc Gooden, Daryl Strawberry, those were the two biggest superstars of the 80s. They led the Mets to a world championship, as I recall. They went to All-Star games. They earned so many honors. They gave us so many moments. Oh boy, haven't their numbers been retired forever? Well, they haven't been. But, you know, things move in mysterious ways sometimes, whether that was the Wilpons, whether that was long memories biased in terms of things that didn't go so well. Maybe policies change over time. I see nothing but good out of this. We ain't running out of numbers, my friend. I think we can spare 16 and 18 from the rotation. I think when you and I and Mets fans look up at those rafters, again, rafters being one of those things, you don't exactly know what they mean, but you know what they are. When we look up at those rafters and we see 16 and 18 alongside those other numbers I mentioned, they will fit like two gloves. It's about time and it's about greatness. Those guys, boy, they don't deserve to be up there of everybody who didn't have a number up there, with maybe one exception. There's no point having that honor anymore. So to one of the two or three greatest pitchers the Mets have ever featured, and to one of the four or five greatest position players the Mets are ever featured, I know you join me in extending just naches, congratulations, joy. This is a great moment for Mets fans. It's a great moment for an era that stays with us. It's a great moment for the greatest era in Mets baseball, the era of Doc Gooden and the era of Darryl Strawberry. They built it. They had help. They were not alone, but they were front and center squarely in the middle of everything that made that a beautiful time. And I'm so happy for them, and I'm so happy for us.
I was thrilled, and I am not in the camp that you have to be extremely judicious, overcautious in retiring numbers. And I'm very glad that we're living the Steve Cohen era where such greatness is being recognized.
I don't see the upside in doing what they begun to do with those guys, which was not give out 16 and 18, although not that long ago they were giving out 16 and 18, come to think of it. But that practice of kind of stealth retiring a number, I don't really see what the benefit is to anybody. Thinking back on the aftermath of those guys' Mets careers, certainly in Strawberry's case, I always had the sense that there was a little, you can't break up with us, we're breaking up with you, by giving out his number pretty quickly. I know Brett Saberhagen was wearing it by 1992, so maybe there was a one-year grace period. And again, if Brett Saberhagen wore 18 in Kansas City, he was a two-time Cy Young winner, I understood why you might want to cater to your new star pitcher. At least you hoped that he would be a star pitcher for you. 16 stayed in mothballs for a little while, but when the Mets had a chance to get Hideo Nomo, Nomo was a number 16 throughout his career, they gave him 16. And for a while, the only 16s went to players who'd worn it elsewhere, like Paul LaDuca or Angel Pagan, or had gone to players who asked to wear it because they loved Doc Gooden. David Cohn, when he returned in 2003, wore 16 for that reason. Derek Bell was a childhood friend of Doc Gooden. He wanted to pay homage to his fellow Tampan. Even as late as 2013, Rick Ankiel grew up in Port St. Lucie, idolized Doc Gooden. He wore 16 for the Mets. But after a while, they were just kind of giving it out to whoever. And Travis Jankowski, who having a pretty good season for Texas, wore 16 last year. Nick Plummer, a couple big home runs for the Mets, wearing number 18 in 2022. All due respect to Nick Plummer, Travis Jankowski. What were you doing giving out 18 and 16 to just two guys who were passing through, no matter that we appreciate their contributions in the moment? Yeah, we're not running out of numbers just because we don't have, you know, a few years ago, we could have said, give the new guy 36, give the new guy 17. Are you sure 24 is on ice? 18 and 16, you know, don't you think twice. Now you got to think twice. You don't think at all because 18 and 16 are going up there. And, you know, listen, when you've been a longtime fan, you see a number and your thought process might not necessarily go to the most obvious choice. Sometimes I would look at somebody wearing 18 and say, yeah, that really reminds me of Joel Youngblood because Joel Youngblood wore 18. Or Yeah, 16. Remember the year that Felix Mian wore before switching to 17? So, your head goes like that. But let's be real. Doc was 16 for 11 seasons. As again, put aside Seaver, was there a better pitcher with a better Met career than Doc Gooden? You can make a case for Jacob deGrom, but we're not in the mood to make cases for Jacob deGrom since last December. So no, it's Seaver, then Gooden, then everybody else. Again, Strawberry, have you seen with a very recent exception who we were just talking about? Have you seen anybody come up from the farm system and be ours in Darryl's case for the first 8 years of his career and just take over games and take over our consciousness, take over a lineup, be all the difference so often? And the answer is no. Not until Pete Alonso do we have anybody like that. Pete Alonso is a different kind of player, maybe a more prolific slugger in the end. Darryl Strawberry did incredible things for incredible teams, and the reason that they were incredible teams had a lot to do with Darryl Strawberry being there. And this was an era where the Mets didn't just have baseball famous players, they had famous players. There's something to be said for that. There's something to be said for the fact that, although it's been used to sort of talk about his downfall, Doc Gooden's picture was on the side of a building, taking up the side of a building at his height. You couldn't turn on the television without a commercial involving Darryl Strawberry telling you to drink milk or maybe something else. They were just everywhere, as were many of their teammates. But again, those guys front and center. The fact that we haven't had versions of that, certainly not together. I mean, it's nice that they were announced together. It's appropriate that they're each going to have their own day because, they're not a matched set, they're individuals. But, that was, again, a magical time. Lord knows I enjoyed the summer of the Magic is Back in 1980 when Darryl Strawberry was a first-round pick out of Crenshaw High School and Doc Gooden was still pitching at Hillsborough High in Tampa. But we were waiting for the real Magic to be conjured. It began that Friday night in May of 1983 when Darryl finally got here. Finally, in the Ronnie Mauricio sense, we've just been hearing for so long. He was, he wasn't that old. But, and then the next year, the team's getting serious about winning, and they bring the 19-year-old who lit up spring training north, and he starts lighting up major league ballparks almost right away. And by the end of that first season, 84, Doc is arguably the best or certainly the most electric pitcher in the major leagues, and that wasn't even the beginning of it. And nor was 85 the end of it. I don't see why you wouldn't want 16 and 18 retired. And if I allow that, yeah, there's arguments to be made, I reject them. I embrace the Doc and Darryl are home in the best way that you can say that about a baseball player and a baseball organization. Those numbers are where they belong, representing that those guys, like Keith, like Coos, like Willie, like Mike, and of course Tom, where they belong. We're going to be careful not to strain our necks, like we're giving up home runs or something, like certain relief pitchers through the years. But we're going to be looking up there a lot. We're going to be our breath is going to be taken away a little bit. Glad we're not the Rockies, because then we would need oxygen. We are playing at sea level, thankfully. Yeah, it's going to be fun. I tell you what, it's so much fun right now when I go to Citi Field and peek up there and see those numbers that set. They've all settled in my mind. Like, yeah, those belong up there. This is great. Look at us. We're a real franchise. We're not hiding the players who made us happy and gave us the moments, which is what we live on. Yeah, let's make it real. Can't wait for those moments next year.
Can I give you two games? One game for each of those players.
You can give me lots of games, but sure.
Two stand out to me. One for Doc, one for Darryl. And for Dwight Gooden, I was at both of these games, so maybe that makes them stand out a little bit more. But September 12, 1984, Dwight Gooden strikes out 16 to break the rookie strikeout record. And I vividly remember Tony Peña not wanting to be the one on the other end of that last strikeout. And he was swinging at anything and everything, just trying to make contact. 16 strikeouts for Doc. The Mets won 2-0. on a Hubie Brooks two-run homer. But I remember Doc perhaps at his best that night.
And that's just one start after Doc throws the first no-hitter in Mets history, but for a scorer's decision, because Keith Moreland chops a ball to Ray Knight on September 7th that he can't handle. Ray Knight's here about a week at that point. He has no, has no currency with us. But for some reason, the official scorer, Maury Allen, says, yeah, that's an infield hit. Could have called an error because Knight could have handled that. It was on NBC, a rare Friday night national telecast. I was able to watch it far from New York. And I thought, like, oh my God, like this could have been the night. And as the night went on, sure as hell could have been. The coda to that, besides the game you described, was the give and take at the U.S. Open going on then as now in Flushing alongside Mets baseball. And John McEnroe has had a, not sure if, I assume he won the tournament, but he was sitting in a post-game, post-match press conference. Maury Allen, a columnist, is covering tennis that day, and he asked John McEnroe about his serve or about something else. And McEnroe says, let me ask you a question. How could you score that a hit? It was an error. We should have had a no-hitter, paraphrasing slightly. But it was the first no-hitter in Mets history, except it's not written down as such. So if anybody wants to give a certain foul ball that may have touched the chalk on June 1st, 2012, any grief, I will answer that Johan's no-hitter was karmic payback for the one we should have had, courtesy of Doc Gooden. Can I tell you about something Doc Gooden did, and then I will turn it over to you to talk about Daryl Strawberry doing something. Do you remember that game very late in the 1985 season, pitched not by Dwight Gooden, but by Ron Darling, where Ron Darling goes out and pitches what I think he would agree was the game of his life, matching zeros with John Tudor in St. Louis, the night that we have to win, because if we don't like sweep the Cardinals as the opener of that series, we have no chance at all with a week to go. And that is like the game that lives on pitching wise from the 1985 season, a beautiful season. The reason I bring up the Ron Darling game, which was nine shutout innings, is that what Darling did the first night of October, Dwight Gooden did basically every 5 days through the month of September. In the heaviest month of the year, in the fiercest year the Mets had ever contested to that point. Understand that from July 29th to September 24th, the Mets and Cardinals traded first and second place continually, with the Mets never more than a game ahead of the Cardinals never more than three in front of the Mets. So this is September. Doc starts five times. He compiles 44 innings, all in must-win games. You know what his earned run average was in September? Zero. 0.00. So I've always wondered, we talk about Santana's no-hitter, Santana's fantastic game against the Marlins, shutting them out just before Shea closed to keep us alive, that Darling game I just mentioned, Seaver's imperfect game, you know, the Jimmy Qualls business, Seaver striking out 10 in a row. We talk about a lot of Al Leiter, that two-hitter to beat the Reds. To win the playoff position in 1999. Bobby Jones, the one-hitter, that also could have been a no-hitter if somebody, Robin Ventura, were a little taller, to beat the Giants, clinch that series. We talk about a lot of different, this may have been the greatest pitching performance in Mets history. And although you have mentioned a really good one, Doc's individual efforts, because they were so constant and common almost, that we never really hear Doc Gooden mentioned as that one particular time. So I would submit that you should take yourself to your local stationery store, as people still go to, right? Grab four paper clips, attach those five games in September together. We're going to call that the greatest starting pitching performance in New York Mets history. And in case you're wondering, 44 innings, five starts, that's not quite nine per start. Why was Doc slacking? Why was he not pitching nine innings every time out? Well, Davey Johnson gave him one inning off in a game where he gave up an unearned run, but it was not to punish him. It was because he had an enormous lead, and to make up for the fact that Doc did not go nine that day. He had a three-run homer early in the game because Doc was like a 230 hitter. The same year, he goes 24-4 with a 1.53 ERA. And by the way, in October, that same series where Darling pitches the game of his life. Yeah, Gooden gave up a couple of runs to the Cardinals, but the Mets won that too. That's how that was a 24th win when we talk about 24-4. I hope people realize it wasn't just about 84 and 85. We'll talk, but geez, what a start to a career. And yeah, I know the career didn't keep going the way we all wish it had, but it went pretty far. We're talking about a guy who won nearly 200 games in the major leagues, who continued to be that opening day ace pitcher for the Mets year after year, continued almost to the very end of his Met career to throw some really great starts. So, you know, I think this is a testament. Number 16 is a testament, not just to those two mind-boggling years when we couldn't believe we were watching a 19-year-old and a 20-year-old do what he did, but a guy who in many ways, you know, developed into a really good veteran pitcher, which, you know, you mentioned setting that rookie strikeout record. You remember whose record he broke? Herb Score. Herb Score, again, was not good in his day with Cleveland in the 50s. He didn't get nearly as far as Doc did in his career. I mean, had a long, productive association with Cleveland, broadcast that for them for many years, but injuries got him. So, you know, it's not as easy as being a phenom and then saying what happened. I mean, gosh, Mark Fidrich was a phenom and injuries, you know, took the best of him. Fernando Valenzuela had his ups and downs. Roughly the same kind of career Doc had at the end, sort of like Oral Hershiser, not quite the same trajectory. David Cone, Brett Saberhagen, all in that realm, guys who had really good careers, and Doc was one of them, so he was not a flash in the pan, I just feel compelled to say. Nor was Darryl Strawberry, but he could deliver some bolts from the blue. Maybe you saw one of them.
I vividly remember this day, and it was October 14th, 1986, which was game 5 of the NLCS against the Astros. And that's the game that people don't always think of in that series because they think of the famous game 6. Game 6, of course, doesn't happen unless the Mets win game 5. And game 5, I was there. There was a rain delay. It was a day game because of the rain out the previous day. And I had tickets in the upper deck and I was on the 7 train. And somebody's asked me where I was sitting. I said upper deck, and they gave me tickets in the mezzanine box because the place was half empty due to all the rain that day. So I was sitting on the first base side in the mezzanine box as Darryl Strawberry hit a game-tying laser beam of a home run off of ex-Met Nolan Ryan. The rest of that game doesn't happen the way it turned out. Charlie Kerfield doesn't make that error. Gary Carter doesn't have the game-winning single unless the game is tied by Darryl Strawberry off Nolan Ryan.
And going 10 innings for the first time in his career in that game, Doc Gooden somehow gets missed as the focal point of a couple of careers. But of course, Nolan Ryan at that stage is pushing 40 and being incredible himself. And the fact that Darryl does what he does in that game, does what he did, I guess it was 3 days earlier because of the rainout Monday. So Saturday, hits a huge 3-run homer off a lefty, Bob Knepper, when it appeared the Mets were, I don't want to say dead and buried, but in the process of burying themselves the way they sometimes could and do. Unlike Doc, where it was all, or it feels front-loaded, even though it wasn't all the first 2 years, Darryl did great things to win the Rookie of the Year award. He does great things to establish himself in the next couple of years. But as of 1986, I think there's still some doubt that Darryl Strawberry is going to come through for you in what people would say was a big spot once and forever. And by the way, that Ron Darling start I mentioned from October of 85, who wins that with a game-winning home run off the clock in St. Louis? Oh, yeah, Darryl Strawberry. But, you know, Straw was capable of going into these funks, capable of over August at Shea Stadium, that sort of thing. Those two home runs against the Astros, both the Knepper one and the Ryan one, I think just changes what we think about when we think about Darryl Strawberry as a big game player. Because, yeah, again, that team did very little hitting in that series until it got very late in the series. And by very late, I mean the 9th inning of game 6. Darryl Strawberry delivers the two biggest hits of that series right up to that moment. I'm always a little wary of without, as in without him, they're not anywhere. Why would they be without him? It's Darryl Strawberry. But I'll tell you what, without Daryl Strawberry, I don't know how the hell they get to game six. I don't know how they fend off Mike Scott in their minds if they can't beat Bob Nepper one day and withstand Nolan Ryan the other day. Just incredible things and an incredible home run that he hits to ice game seven of the World Series after having to put up with the derisive cheers of the Fenway faithful in game five. I think there was a tendency to underrate Darryl a little bit because he was so ballyhooed coming into his career to the point of Doc kind of front-loading because that one world championship is won in his fourth year. I think we tend to lose sight a little bit of how really great Darryl became in the back half of his Met career. You go and look at 87, 88, and 90. He was a little hurt in 89, still did some things, certainly. Those were MVP years. And I think he finished in the top 10 every one of those years, finished second in 88 to gritty gutty Kirk Gibson, who was just such a winner, such a rah-rah guy. I don't know. It was decided that Kirk Gibson should be the MVP by the people who voted on. Daryl Strawberry, the greatest season in the National League that year, was in the midst of a period where he was one of the handful of most dangerous sluggers, speedsters, arms, everything that you could see in the National League. And they didn't go all the way or even to the playoffs in 1990. But when you're done looking up Ron Swoboda's game-by-game logs from 1965, click over to Daryl Strawberry's game-by-game of 1990, particularly June, July, where the Mets are rising from the depths of getting Davey Johnson fired and now suddenly playing like gangbusters under Buddy Harrelson. And you'll see that Daryl, I mean, a lot of players were doing well at that point. Dave Magadan's lighting it up. Greg Jeffries is coming into his own. Mick Reynolds is still productive. You're getting some pitching, but Daryl Strawberry, all of that said, Daryl Strawberry is carrying this team on his shoulders. Maybe it had something to do with the fact he was going to be a free agent, and maybe he wanted to show Frank Cash and he was worth whatever he was asking. And you used a phrase about you wanted Pete Alonso to be a Met forever. It broke my heart that Daryl Strawberry was not a Met forever. It broke my heart when that news came around on a, I believe it was a Friday morning in November of 1990. He was going to the Dodgers. I mean, it wasn't exactly a surprise because he'd been signaling for years, and because that's where he's from. And he said it was the biggest mistake of his life. He didn't say it that day, but he says it now. He said it repeatedly. I can't speak to his life, but certainly from a baseball standpoint, and I know it was always sort of a volatile time when Daryl Strawberry was on the back page, but this was at that point the greatest position player the Mets had ever developed. You're not too far off if you say he's still the greatest position player, most spectacular position player. So a very good position player came to the fore about 20 years ago in Met terms. So maybe he's not the greatest. Maybe David Wright took that, but Darryl's still the greatest home run hitter we ever had until Pete Alonso passes him. I don't know about one at bat with everything on the line, if I'd say yes, Daryl Strawberry, but one at bat, I can only watch one because, oh my God, what's going to happen? I think I'd take Daryl Strawberry because, yeah, he might strike out, he might pop up, as would might anybody. But God, could you imagine if he gets a hold of one? Just that feeling of Daryl Strawberry getting a hold of one. Do you remember what Shea Stadium was like to hit home runs in? How difficult it was to hit home runs. It doesn't feel that way at Citi Field, does it? But Shea Stadium, maybe because we just grew up during a period where nobody, for the most part, hit home runs in Shea Stadium. And we had this guy who just gravity meant nothing to him. Distance, 410 feet to center, meant nothing to him. Just put your head down and jog. Like you've been there before, also meant nothing to him. He was going to take his time if he felt like taking his time, because he was who we came to watch, and we all had our eyes on him, and he knew it. One of my favorite things he ever said in retirement, heard him interviewed a couple of years ago by Warner Wolf. Here's a name. Warner Wolf asked, "Hey Daryl, how did you deal with the Boston fans yelling Daryl, Daryl?" And other fans picking that up. Did it bother you? Daryl said, Hey, I was just glad they knew I was in the ballpark. Let me tell you something. We all knew when Darryl was in the ballpark, and those were the at-bats you didn't miss. And there have been a handful of those players in our lives. Darryl Strawberry may have been the first of them where we said, not only do I not want to miss the chance, he's going to hit a home run. So we might have said that for Dave Kingman. We didn't want to miss anything he would do because the sky was the limit. And how often did he reach the sky? Like Doc, pretty often.
So the Mets are going to have 2 days to honor those two great players. I wonder if they'll be the same weekend because so many of the guests will be the same. So you don't have to have other members of the 86 Mets travel two separate times. But I'm glad that they are going to be honoring them separately because that means that we're going to have two days to remember the Mets of the past.
Yeah, like I said before, you know, they're individuals, not a match set. So each should have his day. Each should have his family. Each should have our focus. And you know what? If some 1986 teammate has to make two trips in, I'm thinking Steve can take care of that.
And we can't wait to talk about that next year on National League Town. One more thing. Littering is a swing and a miss. Don't do it. A message from National League Town.
Clean up after yourselves.
I can't believe that's a sponsor on Met Games. The New York City Department of Sanitation telling us not to litter. I was thinking about that, do we have to be told not to litter? And then on Monday, I was driving back from New Jersey because I saw Bruce on Sunday in the Meadowlands. I'm driving back on the New Jersey Turnpike, and a guy in front of me flings some papers out of his car on the New Jersey Turnpike. So I guess we do need that reminder from the New York City Department of Sanitation. Don't litter.
I'm glad to know you got to see Jay Bruce. How's he doing?
And that'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We'll be back next week with more. We thank you for listening. So until next week, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm still schwitzing. I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Their latest album, From Coma to Catharsis, is now available on vinyl. For more information and tour dates, check them out on Bandcamp.